Hey, did you know we've got an Art of Hosting coming up?
It's pretty exciting. I mean, it's the first time we've run an open enrollment training of any kind at the outside, you know, that's face-to-face since we started the organization. And it's lovely to be going back to our roots to offer an Art of Hosting, also called the Art of Hosting Conversations That Matter, or the Art of Hosting and Harvesting Conversations That Matter.
Or the Art of Participatory Leadership.
Yes, many names.
But it is all in the outside style, right? Yeah. So this training will be 3 days, July 17th through 19th, 2024 in Nova Scotia. And it will be some of the things that if you know about Art of Hosting, you know, we'll be teaching facilitation methodologies and techniques. We'll be teaching about worldviews. It will be immersive and you'll be practicing. So that will be happening those 3 days.
Great. And what we can guarantee you is that you'll walk out with a sense of architecture. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you design participatory interventions into the places where you live, work, and play? And that is really the root of it. The methodologies, the toolbox is easy to download from the internet.
That's right.
But the architecture, the design architecture, your capacity to actually pull together those things or even make them up yourself will be dramatically increased. So we totally look forward to welcoming you to Nova Scotia. Myself and Choose are hosting it with Gabriel Donnelly and Jean-Paul Ganzoni.
Well, that's what I was going to say. You can absolutely get the methodologies online for sure, but you'll get to experience them with an amazing group of people. The 25 people or so who have already registered are amazing, and I want to spend time with them. And then you'll get time with the outside team and benefit from our experience doing these processes all over the world. So please, please join us. Information is in the show notes. We'd love to see you in July.
See you then.
Hello, hello, and welcome to Find the Outside, the podcast. We are excited to be back today in our Changing Planet series. We are with Drs. Janine Marie Haugen and Dr. Laura Blakeman, and I met them through their work at the Animas Valley Institute, and they do all sorts of cool stuff in the world. So, you know, part of me wants to say I met them through doing some racial justice work with their wilderness guides. But as I was saying earlier, like, that is such a small piece of understanding what these two women are doing in the world. And so I'm really, really excited to bring them to you and have Tim and I talk with them, because you know how sometimes you talk to people, Tim, and you're like, what? I didn't understand the world like that. And then, like, they say something and you're like, that feels true. And I didn't have access to it before. And so this is my experience of, I know, I'm sorry if that feels like pressure. I don't mean it to be like pressure, but you're not, that's what's going to happen today, friends. And I just want to prepare people. No, I just want to prepare people that as much systems changed, Tim, as you and I have done in the world, when I came across these two women, I was like, they know something I don't. And people should know about it. So how's that?
I love that. You know, it's the worst. I get, because, I mean, you know, we facilitate groups all kinds of ways and shapes and forms. And when someone introduces you as an excellent facilitator or someone who's fantastic at their gig in the opening comments of the event, you know, my words are usually like, well, I'd love for you all just to like hold judgment until the end, you know? Just gives me a bit of space, you know? Anyway. Podcast listeners, you can't see the screen that I'm looking at, but I've only met the two of you in the last 15, 20 minutes, but the amount of smile that comes through, which podcasters don't get to see, it's just this glimmering resource of loveliness. And so just like, thank you for just turning up the way you are into this call with, there's some real effervescence just from the word go. So I'm just really grateful for it. It would be lovely just to hear you two talk a little bit about yourselves by way of introduction. Like, what is your work together? What do you create together? What is it that binds you in whatever you might call the work?
I want you to go first on that one, LB.
Oh, really? Oh, yes. Janine. Oh, well, thank you. How kind. I think Janine is asking me to do that because I'm going to venture to say neither one of us love talking about ourselves and what we do. In fact, it's one of the questions that gives me some anxiety. It's probably the hardest question that you will ask this whole time, in part because the through line of my work is visible to me, but not so visible always to others, because I've been up to lots of different things in the world. But maybe I'll just start to say, Janine and I met through the Animas Valley Institute work, and I was coming in as a trainee. I was 29 years old, coming in as a trainee to the guiding work that the Animas Valley Institute does. And Janine was one of my mentors. And so I still consider her my mentor, my elder, and a friend and colleague now. So I'm now a guide at the Animas Valley Institute and work on the leadership team there, which is always a ride. And I also have co-founded a kind of social impact educational initiative. That's the bulk of my work. That's based up in the Canadian Rockies with other colleagues and friends and my love. And so Janine and I kind of weave in and out of work together, but we're certainly companions on the way.
Janine, what might you add to that?
Wow. I'd say we are mutually dreaming. We're dreaming a new world. And Laura, LB as I know her, has developed some very thoughtful and practical methods, I think. Put pieces in place for systems change, for people change, people changing. And I think I am more of a dreamer. Like, I'm not somebody who would ever found an organization. Yeah, I'm just not that kind of person, but I'm glad to be in the conversation and the mutual dreaming and support things where I can in my particular ways. I believe that what we imagine, even if we're in our own wandering spaces, I believe that what we imagine is important, that somehow we seed the collective psyche or the collective imagination by what we imagine and dream. So I think I'm kind of a dreamer.
Well, I would just say that is completely welcome here. And I want to ask you both, what is it that you're dreaming together? And that can be as concrete as what is Animas Valley Institute's to do? What's its dream in the world that you're seeking to realize? Or it could be as nebulous as what is in your hearts that you all come together to dream about? Yeah.
What a question. Oh. Well, what came to mind immediately for me are some of the conversations that Janine and I have been having recently. And it's mostly in our, we could say our private lives, our personal lives, but feels so much bigger than that. And that's this dream of living in community. Practicing, embodying a way of being that is in relationship, in wild relationship with the more than human world, with the human and the more than human world, like how we might be affected together in collective spaces by the dreaming of Earth, by the bigger dreaming that's happening with us. And so we've talked a lot recently about home, about relationship to place, about a grounding the work, whatever the work may be, whatever form the work is taking in situ and in our bodies and in relationship and around the table. And so there's this, this kind of tactile togetherness and, an aesthetic, I would say, that Janine and I are dreaming into together in, and that's the first thing that came to mind. And of course, that's related to and totally different from, in some ways, the kind of concrete vocation that we've been called into, which takes many different forms. So maybe I'll just start there and pass it over to you, Janine, to add or change or deny.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. Thank you. I wouldn't have thought to say that. And that's like the anchor. That's the root, the rooted part. Because Animas Valley Institute, which is how we know each other, maybe we would have known each other anyways, but that happens to be how we know each other. Animas does not have a place. It's not place-based. We rent retreat centers and we base camp, you know, we have backcountry camps and all over the world, but we don't have a place. And so that's something that's exactly what LB said about we are dreaming something that has to do with community and place, and place that is very deeply, that we're very deeply in relationship with that place, with all of the creatures of that place and the landforms and the history and the neighbors, even if they're people we might not choose necessarily. But yeah, that's been a dreaming that we have been sharing for the last few years.
Why do you think you're being called into that dream together? What is it about now that makes that dream so visceral to you, so real, so important to be in together?
Well, you want to find your people. We want to find our people.
Right.
And just a simple metaphor, how can we build lifeboats now, or sanctuaries, or places of gathering? How can we create good, safe, sacred, also challenging spaces to be in these turbulent times, and possibly very turbulent times coming?
Yeah, there's something for me too about just recognizing context, the context of our times right now, with the amount of interconnectivity and information and this kind of hyper global perspective that many of us hold, in large part because of our technologies and because of our work. Many of us are working translocal, or we're flying about and we're connecting, you know, as we are right now, across distance and time and space. And while I find that to be inspiring and necessary and a part of Earth's dreaming to help us see how interconnected we are and how one little movement here makes such a big difference, you know, somewhere that I'm not. At the same time, I believe it's even more critical to counter the hyper-global with a hyper-local. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure really what that looks like. So for me, it's not a regressive, romantic, I want to go back impulse. It's something like, how are we dreaming forward into sustainable futures and possibilities that are soul-centric, that are of the whole person, that that honor all the people, again, human and other than human. And I think that there's some learning and some experimentation that is a big part of my wondering, dreaming, I long to participate in that learning. I feel like it's critical.
And the community part seems so important, because in our hyper-modern world, hyper-individual world, everybody's an individual, and we stand on our own two feet and pull ourselves up by our bootstraps and so on. The community seems so important now, and a way for us to be stronger, more resilient, in changes, in all the changes that we seem to be amidst. That it's something I always think of this, that the Dalai Lama says that the next Buddha will be a Sangha, a community. The next Buddha is not one person. The next Buddha is a community in practice together. So yeah, for us to be in practice, you know, like Tuesday, maybe you'll find out what it's like to be in an immersion with our guides, and it's not the same as our everyday lives. And even for the guides, it's different because we're in this beautiful intensity of practice of different life ways, really, like listening to dreams. And that's a part of our what we do, how we begin the day. Most days when we're guiding, we don't necessarily do that, at home. And some of the guides probably do, but all of us probably don't. And so to be more in a community where that's where we might share some of the more non-ordinary experiences, where we share them in community, something like that.
Well, I mean, you all have used several terms that are quite evocative, and I want to really permission us to not necessarily have to get to a brass tacks that you do this, then you do this, or here are our clear methods. You know, like let's actually be in a conversation that might allow kind of non-ordinary ways of knowing. That non-ordinary is a word you used. You used more than human. I think the tagline perhaps of the NS Valley Institute is guiding a descent to the soul. So they're like, you're using words like soul, right? And I'm quite curious, like this is very different language in imagining a different future than Tim and I use when we're imagining a different future with groups of people, right? And I feel like there's something around I want to ask you about everything, more than human. Other ways of knowing, descent to soul. What is it, right? Like this is not typical language for folks who want to accompany the world to its next evolution.
But nor is it frivolous language.
Right, right.
Right, I just want to say, like hearing those phrases, you know, like it feels to me like this is deliberately and well-chosen language, a language that is reflective of a practice, of a of a worldview, of a set of beliefs, of maybe even a set of relationships. Yep. And it would be wonderful just to hear you take us under the hood there. I think that's where you're going, Jeez. Yeah. I'd love to hear more about that. Yeah.
Go ahead, Janine. Where would you start us off?
Well, because I just saw our friend David Abram, I would start with more than human.
Great.
It's a popularized. I don't think David was quite the originator of this phrase, but he's certainly the one who used it in a way that brought it into the culture. David Abram is a cultural ecologist with a couple of books. The first one was called Spell of the Sensuous, Perception and Language in a More Than Human World. That it's the world does not only include us, that we are sharing the world with all these other beings and presences and intelligences and so forth. That's more than human. I sometimes use a phrase other than human to indicate the others, all the other lives too.
And maybe just to be very explicit about that, there's probably more here, but just to name that language, Tim, as you were saying, intentionally chosen is pointing to a world view or maybe a part of the dreaming we're wanting to participate in, which is not, you know, it's more than the human. It's not just anthropocentric perspective, that there's mm-hmm. a way that we're participating in a network of relationships. And however you understand that, whether for you that's a kind of sacred experience or just a fact of life, it helps, I think, create some space in what otherwise is a very kind of human-centric, often conversation. And yeah, we're using words like soul. maybe this is the moment to say that the Animus Valley Institute really has been the source or the holder of that work is Janine's beloved Bill Plotkin. And it really has been a body of work that's been developed over many decades and lots of many different contributors coming in and offering and shaping, co-shaping that work. And, you know, we probably all hold to, we have different ways of describing things or maybe different or nuanced perspectives inside that body of work. And so one of the things, you know, use the word soul-centric. It really is a lens that I look through. And it's related to the more than human, I would say, because there's an understanding that I hold that's like a what if. Mm. You know, some of these things are difficult to define or get your hands around. But as a what if, soul is this idea that each thing, each being, each creature, human and other than human, animate or inanimate, has a kind of particularity, a unique essence, a contribution in a network of relationships. And so to be soul-centric is to acknowledge that I am me and my particular way of loving the world is something that is my, you know, greatest contribution, you could say, to do that consciously, to love the world that consciously and all of my, with my full essence, my full heart. That is a kind of soul, a way that my soul becomes a participatory member. Mm. And it's also to say, it's not just about me and my uniqueness. It's also, I am who I am because of these networks of relationships that I can only be, if we took like an ecological view, I have been shaped in a very particular way in a network of relationships that's not time bound. You know, we are part of a bigger unfolding story. So this is a kind of, it's like a whole cosmology, but just to say that soul for me is really about both becoming aware of and then very intentionally offering from, you know, my essence, our essence, our way of loving, something like that. And this is a big rabbit hole. And I'm, you know, anyway, I'll just stop there.
Well, sometimes the most interesting things are, they're big question marks, aren't they? And that's what makes them so compelling. That's what makes it a rabbit hole worth going down, is that like you dive in one end of a question mark and then you're in the maze, you know, and I just love that. Like, what are we going to do? Not go there? You know?
Well, maybe it would be helpful for a listener to hear that a part of our work at Animus, and I'd say it's a big part, but it's a part, is, you know, people come with a longing to know themselves in a deeper way, to be offering to the world in a kind of full, sometimes we use these placeholder words like fully free or undomesticated or wilder way of being. And we attempt to guide people into that really mysterious territory that is like deeper layers of identity or deeper layers of being. Janine.
And the tricky thing, one of the tricky things about this is it's not the soul identity, or sometimes we use the phrase mythopoetic identity. I know that's really going to clear things up for you.
Yeah, actually that was helpful.
It's not something that we choose. It's what we can discover, you know, but it's not like choosing a career and going to study for the career. It's something that we might discover our particular way of, our unique way of engaging in participatory relationships. And it might be something that you, nobody else can see it. It's like the William Stafford poem, there's a thread that you follow. Mm. It goes among things that change, but it doesn't change. I can't remember the next line. Do you remember that? People wonder what it is that you're following, because something like they can't see it. You have to explain about the thread. But it doesn't, it's not so culturally easy as saying, well, I'm an accountant.
Right. Right.
Yeah, it's much more mysterious.
Well, you use the word, Laura, use the word, it's a whole cosmology. And I don't know if we want to, you know, dive into that, but I do feel like we do, like part of the reason we asked you on was this worldview or cosmology or this way you begin to imagine moving forward well together, you know, which is certainly rooted in what is uniquely ours or us. I don't know if that's the language that that works, but also is like deeply interconnected, right? So I would say mm-hmm. that this is certainly what Tim and I try to do in the world as we talk about systems change, right? And yet you all, that we know that the lens with which we approach that, it's our own quote we use all the time, right? The impact of, and I'm going to get it wrong because I'm terrible at quotes, but like the success of the intervention depends on the interiority of the intervener, right? And so we know that there is something about this deep place that our action comes from. And I feel like you all are that and to the right or to the left. I don't care which direction, but like, it's like, there's something about the worldview or the lens you're approaching that feels worthwhile sharing with people in the way that you are, because it would change everything about how we might move forward in the world. Does that land? There's not really a question there, but I guess I'm inviting you into it a little bit more because that's what we want to hear.
Yeah, Janine, what's coming to mind for me, not to single you out, but is, you know, your doctoral framework, your whatever we want to call that, your research question or territory. And I'm just curious if there's something there of your own worldview that might be helpful for people to hear right now.
Ooh. Ooh.
I have a question just yeah. from reading some of your writings, if that would be mm-hmm. helpful. You talk about an animate worldview, which please don't assume our listeners know what that is. Right. We actually, yeah. you talk about unlearning the Western dead world universe worldview, yeah. right? That yeah. is, again, evocative language. I think, you know, our listeners, what is an animate worldview? What is the Western dead universe worldview that many of us or most of us are living in? Even that would be, I think, a little bit of a peek into your worldview and cosmology.
Okay. Well, the most people in the modern world who don't live in indigenous cultures were raised in a world that it's all about consumption, that consumerism is the religion, getting stuff, more stuff, and getting a lot of stuff. And it doesn't matter how we get the stuff because it's all there for us to get. And there's nothing but us. Nothing matters to the other beings. The only beings who really matter are us, human beings. And everything is here for us. Forests, diamonds, water, oil, and so forth. It's all dead and unfeeling, insentient matter. And that's part of the industrial world. of course. And you know, people have written philosophical tomes on this, so I won't. That's all I'll say. But animate world is like, for a lot of people in the modern world, a lot of people who are a little bit in the progressive culture now might encounter animate world for the first time on psychedelics. That suddenly, even the sofa has a personality. Or the house, or, and then if one goes outside and the trees are the, we hear the singing of the trees that's been going on all along. So that's how some of the modern human might discover animacy. But this is a likely the world that human beings originated in. Everything, the humans were not centered on themselves. Everything was participating and in conversation. And we know from the old stories, the myths, even the European myths, but the old stories of the traditional cultures, the conversations that were had between people, human beings, and the other beings, because everything was experienced as being intelligent, alive, participating. So what we have been trained to cancel out that view of the world, which probably almost everybody had something like that as children, where the others were alive, we were engaged with the other beings. And people also have that with pets. Like, the pets are very much in reciprocal conversation with their people. But it seems that once upon a time, for all of us, our ancestors, that was the world. Now we have a phrase for that, animate world. It was and is for people, many people still, it is the world. Did I answer that?
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. That was great. That was great. Laura, is there anything you might want to add before Tim asks the question? Or?
Yeah, I think that worldview has implications at different scales.
Yeah.
Like, there's the profound intimacy and aliveness that happens in relationship that all of us know on some level, whether it's with our human beloveds or a pet or a place, that there's a kind of co-shaping that can happen in that reciprocal relationship that is profound developmentally.
Mm-hmm.
It is profound in inspiring our character, our being, our approach to things. That relationship is everything. So on a very intimate individual level, it's profound. Maybe we could even say, you know, I don't research in this area, but there's an epidemic of loneliness, and we're surrounded by more people than ever. Mm-hmm. And what might this what might sensitizing ourselves to actually a very natural way of being human, what might that do for us individually and our own well-being? And then, of course, you were gesturing toward our change work, or how we move forward, holding some of these worldviews. And so, again, there's you know, ways that we might approach really complex challenge domains, or ways that we might approach difficult family dynamics, or there's ways we might approach, you know, climate catastrophe that enables us to not just be on the margins looking in with great advice, but actually embedded in participatory relationship with this planet. Mm-hmm. With this planet as a being that feels and knows and is its own, you know, autonomous being. And whether or not that's true with a capital T, it almost doesn't matter because it invites a different approach. Yeah. And it brings the heart in, and it brings in these other ways of knowing that have been marginalized to the arts and entertainment to be consumed when the day's work is done. It brings all of that in. And I know you two, you know, move from this place too, that there's a moreness that we're invited into when we engage in our full aliveness and are engaging all the others as alive beings as well.
I have these little rituals in my life, you know, like every night before I go to bed, I step outside and look at the stars, usually barefoot because I'm wearing my pajamas and the dog's got to go out one last time before going to sleep. But it's every night I'll just step out and look at the stars, you know. I travel a lot for my work. So I'll end up in different hotel rooms or different places. But like every time before I leave a room, I end up saying thank you to the room, even if it's a Best Western or some, like, you know, I always turn around just like, thanks for the sleep. Or sometimes I'm like, thanks for the sleepless night. That was important. You know, when I'm going in to host a session, I'll go in and I'll look around the room and like ask for any help. I'll be like, I really welcome any help as I work with this group. I usually step outside and I look at the nature that's around us and I'm like, this is what we're doing here. I just invite any support that is available for what we're trying to do. I believe what we're doing is good and helpful, you know, and if there's anything here that could lend itself to what we're doing, I'd be really grateful. You know, when I don't know what to do, I nearly always step outside. And I just think for many of us, there's these little rituals in our lives that we maybe don't even know, we maybe don't even notice that we're doing. I mean, I don't think Tuesday knows these things about me. It's not like I don't really advertise them. It's just what I do every day as part of being Tim. You know, there's certain places I go to again and again and again in the forest outside my house. When I go home to England, there's places that are specific that give me the relationship to that bigger connectedness that you're talking about. And I'm not going to that place. I mean, I love the place, but also that place, suddenly there's a squirrel there and we're having a chat. Oh, how you doing? I didn't see you sitting there. Thanks for stopping by. And all of that begins to happen. And so I'm really intrigued about this idea that there's a wild part of us that needs to be invited back in. And I'm intrigued by there's a mythologist I follow, a man called Martin Shaw. And he wrote, yeah, familiar with him. He wrote a fantastic book called The Courting the Wild Twin. And, you know, and he's going back to some kind of like ancient European myths about that when you're born, there's a wild twin that's thrown out of the window. And so when you said, you know, the mythopoetic, I was like, oh, crap, Martin, yeah, that, you know. And so there's something that's being... Like, of course, there's the macro work that Tuesday, you know, 80% of my portfolio is climate change work right now. I just came back from work last week around green stormwater infrastructure across the US. Like, that's how practical this shift is right now. But on another level, it's that there's a piece of us that needs to be reintegrated. There's some unlearning or some reconnection. Martin Shaw calls it the wild twin. This old story calls it the wild twin. And I'm just interested to hear you both talk about that, like, because that feels infinitely within my power. If there's a piece of me I can invite back in, if I don't have to solve green stormwater infrastructure or heat inequity in our urban centers through tree canopy, you know, I mean, these are big things and they need our attention, but there's something in me, the wild twin I can invite back in, the unlearning I can do, the relationship I can be in. In my experience is it's deeply comforting and deeply hopeful. And it gives me the capacity to engage with some of these macro insurmountable challenges we seem to be faced with, you know, in a way that isn't panicked. And I'd love to hear the two of you talk about just that personal integration piece, like the pieces of us, the pieces of myself I've dismissed that needs the wild. You keep talking about wildness. Yeah, I've said enough. I'd love to hear you talk.
You go on that one, LB. if you will.
Maybe just to say wildness is a kind of stand-in word for like the moreness, the moreness of things, the moreness of ourselves, of the world. And so sometimes the English language is inadequate, but there's something about that moreness that's the things that are at the edges or that are margin, you know, in the margins. Well, I think there's, you know, there's a number of different places I could go there. I too am a really practical, you know, I'm very much hands in and hands on in my vocational work. You know, I guide with Animus, but I also work with a number of, with folks who are doing what you're doing there, Tim. They're very much immersed in some of the stickiest, most complex challenges we're facing on this planet. And the nature of complexity, this is one of the geeky things that I have learned and love and know intuitively, is we cannot solve from a purely kind of rational, linear place. We can't actually, even as practical as some of these, you know, steps are in our change work, really we can't approach the whole without our own moreness, individually and collectively. And so one of the ways I understand that wildness is, at least in how I was acculturated, is that there are ways of knowing, there are fluencies, we might call it things like emotional intelligence or the imagination as a way of knowing, or my body's sensations or shapes or responses, or the way that I'm cracked open to the world, like my deep intuition, that without these faculties, I'm approaching wildly complex challenges partially. Always.
I love that. I'm not using all the tools at my disposal. And I know tool isn't the right word. I know tool isn't the right word, but it's just like, why wouldn't I bring all of myself to bear?
Yeah, and I'm not even being fully human. Right. It's human to be staggered by the awe, by the wonder, by the ineffability, by the impossibility. This is human to feel like, oh, I'm inept. I'm a little thing, you know, I'm squishy, I'm going to die soon. You know, like these are human impulses and we leave them at the door often in a lot of spaces that I'm in. And so there's something about, you know, wildness, the moreness, altered states, you know, something we're talking about, or non, you know, linear states, that's been kind of at the edges of this conversation too, of like, how do we bring the moreness of ourselves home to ourselves so that when we're approaching really sticky, tricky, complex challenges, which whether you're raising a family or trying to intervene in energy transition, you're immersed in complexity, like to approach with that level of moreness and that level of humanity, to be really human. So, that's work, and those are practice muscles, which I think is really empowering and fun, actually, to say, you know, what if we were able to build some of these muscles that have atrophied developmentally for many of us, so that more information, more feeling, more sentience, more possibility is online, is at, you know, at our fingertips. And maybe it won't make a difference. You know, maybe we'll still flounder in the face of these challenges, but at least I'll feel alive in the doing of it.
Thank you.
Thank you, LB. That was wonderful. Very good. Thank you. Let's see. And Tim, because you said, you spoke about how you thank the hotel room when you leave and so on. So I just wanted to reflect on that a little bit and how, in my cosmology, that is a way, that kind of acknowledgement of the space, the place, the presences that we're amidst is a way of softening our own psychic filters all the ways that we block the animate world, all the ways that we block all the voices that are present with us, probably almost all the time, but we're trained to block them. You know, the children who hear that from their parents, that's just your imagination, for example. And we learn to disregard things that we're present with. And so there are ways that we can help open that up, all those filters. And for example, that wonderful little practice you shared with us is a way, like you've made yourself vulnerable there when you acknowledge that there's something you're speaking to when you are thanking the hotel room or whatever. You're making an acknowledgement that there's intelligence, there's something. And so in my sense, the more we can erode our customary psychic filters, the more we might hear the voices of the world. And we're not necessarily going to hear this as audible, but we might be struck with impressions, strange impressions. So Tuesday's nodding. So we might be struck with big ideas, big crazy-ass ideas. To me, it seems that sometimes at least this kind of impression receiving, we may be receiving something that is from the world, that it is not just generated, self-generated, that there is a conversation that is happening, that the world is reaching for us, that this big ideas now that we need to transition our energy needs and so on, that it may be that those that we are getting instructions, or we can make ourselves more available to impressions from the other than human, the more than human world. And maybe that's all I'll say about that.
Well, I have a question then, because I can, and you were able to see me nodding as you both were speaking. I can imagine our podcast listeners going like, yeah, wait, I have had, you know what I mean? Like whatever I call intuition or a strange experience with a tree that I don't tell anyone about, or, you know what I mean? All the different things that people might be thinking about in this moment. And they're saying yes to what everyone here is saying. And they're saying, how do I open up to it more? How do I decrease my psychic blocks? I'm with you, but I don't know like how to open up even more. And what is advice you might give, or places to start, or ways, you know, that people can just, if they're hearing you and like doing a small nod, what might they begin to practice?
Boy, there's so many things. The first thing that struck me is to say, some way of gesturing or saying, yes, I heard that. And what we at Animus often, we might suggest to people if they're struck by something or they get an image, sometimes this can might be our own material, our own.
Right.
Or it might be, especially if it's strange, who knows? But if some kind of image comes, sometimes drawing or shaping that image, you know, it's a way of saying, I heard you. Remember that old movie, Close Encounters of the Third Kind? And he sculpts the devil's tower because he's seen that somehow and he sculpts it. So something like that, it's a way of saying, yes, I'm listening. I heard that. I see that. So speaking back in that language, in this mysterious language, and then it's sometimes it can just saying I'm listening, it's possible that helps open the door, open the channels, so we might receive more. And also, just to say, it's not the same as treating the world as an oracle for us personally.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But we might be being asked to participate. We might be being invited. You know, we might be given instructions, or at least hints or something about what is ours to do now as human beings.
Yeah, I think just to underline again, Janini said this, or your version of this, I think if you're listening and you're nodding, or you're curious, or maybe you're thinking, what are these ones on about? But wait, no, but there's a little longing. Like, I wish the world were that way. Mm-hmm. If it's any of that, you might, in a way that's meaningful to you, say, I'm going to open myself to listen. Mm-hmm. I'm going to experiment here. I'm going to hold a what if. I'm going to, whoever you want to direct that to, or whatever you want to direct that to, maybe it's to your own self, maybe it's to a greater sense of mystery or something outside of you, or the earth as this incredible planet that we're all on, to actually say, I'm going to say I'm available. And not only that, but I'd like to participate in the conversation. I have a longing to. And as long as that kind of is done in a way, again, that's meaningful to you. You don't need to look anything up, or it just, however that is for you, then start paying attention. And it'll be what it is for you. You know, we have different ways of being in relationship. And again, the oracle piece, you know, there's lots of different ways. But often when folks come early on, they say something like, I had an owl dream and I looked it up on Google and owls mean this. And so this is how I'm being communicated with. And often we say, just be in relationship with owl, with that particular owl, that one. And so we invite, just like you would with any other human relationship. We know how to do this. You don't say, well, what does Tuesday mean to me in my life? Tuesday just showed up. Like, Tuesday must have some significance. I'm going to analyze Tuesday or look Tuesday up on Google. And no, we say, well, hey, Tuesday, wow, let's be in relationship. I'd love to get to know you more.
And big Tuesday. Get in Tuesday.
That's right.
Tuesday has named, just podcast listeners, Tuesday's named herself on this particular pog as Big Chews. You know, and it generally alternates between Big Chews and Big Mama Chews. Let's be honest. Those are the two. Those are the two that generally turn up as the podcast names, you know.
Yeah. That's great.
So Tuesday must be in relationship with the world in a way that enables this bigness to happen occasionally. Or that there might be an inquiry into Big Mama. What does that mean? How does that shift her way of being? So anyway, lots of ways in, and lots of practices there. But
if people want to find you, right, if they want to find you, if they want to experience what you're talking about, if they want to be in a guided environment, if they want to know more about the work you're doing, Laura, you know, like, how do folks find you?
Good luck.
Aha, good. Good luck, listeners.
www.animus.org.
Okay.
Animus.org.
Cool. Yeah.
Well, and then I'll say it because she doesn't appear to be, but Janine has some beautiful writing that is available if you look hard enough. If you turn under rocks on the internet, you might come across some incredible writing that is its own immersive experience, and I think would feed you. So please look up Janine Marie Haugen on Google or wherever you find your prophetic wild beings. And aside from Animus, I do guide for Animus. That's my deep pleasure work. I also, again, co-steward this, a learning inquiry called the Wolf Willow Institute. And we take some of the things that we've been talking about today in the deep inner and the dreaming, and we match them with the big outer systems change work, social impact work, social entrepreneurship work. And we're really committed to supporting the people that are building the future we most want to live in. And so that's wolfwillow.org. And that's based in the Canadian Rockies, but we work all over North America. So that's not just my dream child, but it's a good learning initiative. So come join us.
And fear not, dear listener, we will put some links in the chat so you can at least begin your burrowing from the links we send you.
Great.
That's
right. We'll put them in the show notes.
Yeah, I would say they'll definitely be in the show notes. And and you know, worst comes to worst, reach out to Tim and I. We know how to get you. Like we're aware of that. So, because we need to kind of wrap up time wise, I feel like there's just so much we didn't even touch. But I'm curious. Y'all have been at this for some time, right? This isn't new. You can feel the depth of your practice as you speak about it. And so I'm curious, like, what keeps you going? We often ask our guests, like, what's that like back pocket, that thing you keep in your back pocket that kind of keeps you moving in this world, in the face of all the collapse we've talked about, right? In the face of the unrelenting complexity that we are facing. And so poem, quote, in whatever it might be, but we'd love to just ask you what keeps you going.
Such a good question. I don't actually have a nice response. Right now, I feel I'm very much in a listening, like fallow in some way. I'm just laid out and bare and listening for what is being invited now. Yeah, I would say that's...
I love that, right? It matches the season, but it also is really radical. Like, how often do we actually allow ourselves to lie fallow and listen?
Mm-hmm. And also, I'm not a very active Animus guide anymore by my own choice. I'm just kind of moving, but it's not... real goal-oriented moving. I don't seem to have that mode.
Great.
Yeah, moving in some other or some, yeah, it's not quite what I have been doing. So fallow listening and trying to take in and hold. You know, I'm actually trying to learn how to hold better all the enormity of our times, the radical extremes of grief and amazement. So
thank you.
LB.
A beautiful image. Yeah, it's a beautiful image, Janine, lying fallow. I think I'm influenced. I mean, primarily what keeps me going is my relationship to the land that I live on. Just being in real deep, committed, married to this place, long-term relationship. There's something really fulfilling about that. Feels like some days the most important work I could do is be here intensely and fully. But in terms of, you know, other thinkers and resources, I'm really interested, you know, what Janine and I have spoken about today. It's not rarefied. It's not just our own thing. I think there's lots of people talking about how to be human, more fully in these times. And so I like hearing from other perspectives and other cultures and other backgrounds. And so Minna Salami's work, she just published a book called Sensuous Knowledge, finding that really rich from a like a Black feminist perspective on soul. And then Vanessa Andriotti and Melanie Goodchild's work in particular on some relational systems thinking ideas from Indigenous perspectives. And then I often joke that my literary boyfriend is a German named Andreas Weber, who wrote a book called Matter and Desire. And I'm really into the kind of reclaiming the erotic as something more than the sexual.
Beautiful.
And he has a really wonderful way into that. So those three.
Amazing.
Great.
Thank you both so much for coming on and just like opening up the window into your world a little bit. I think both for Choose and I, but to the people who are listening in North America and all over the world to the pod. So enormous gratitude for your willingness to just be here and be unapologetically you. And enormously grateful for that.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so, so much. And I just want to say, I know our listeners' heads have been blown off. I know that felt like pressure at the beginning, but I'm really sure that that's happened. So I stand by my introduction.
Nice. Good job, Choose.
Richard, what do you do for a living?
Yeah. Good book ending there, Choose. I like it.
Thank you for the invitation. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.